Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Krupa Pardi. Thanks for being with us. Coming up, wasteful pennies. Why the new president of the United States wants to get rid of 1 cent coins. Also, why artificial intelligence could impact women more than men in the workplace. And in about 30 minutes' time, we'll hear from Bukavu in the DRC as a resident there describes her fears as rebels from the M23 group take over the city. But let's begin in Germany and the annual Munich Security Conference. This is where world leaders gather to debate the most pressing challenges to international security. Much focus has been on how to end the war in Ukraine and on Europe's defence spending. The meeting happens in the shadow, of course, of that phone call just a few days ago between President Trump and the Russian President Vladimir Putin, in which the leaders agreed to begin negotiations to end the war. Mr. Trump had said US, Russian and Ukrainian officials would meet in Munich, but that has not happened. There have instead been lots of questions about where Ukraine fits into these conversations. President Zelensky took to the podium this morning and he warned that without involving Ukraine in the talks, the US president risked playing into the hands of the Russian president.
If we are left out of negotiations about our own future, then we all lose. Look at what Putin is trying to do now. This is his game. Putin wants one-on-one talks with America. Just like before the war, when they met in Switzerland and looked like to carve up the world. Next, Putin will try to get the US president standing on Red Square on May 9th this year, not as a respected leader, but as a prop in his own performance. We don't need that. We need real success. We need real peace.
He also said that Europe should step up and create its own military.
Let's be honest, now we can't rule out the possibility that America might say no to Europe on issues that threaten it. Many leaders have talked about Europe that needs its own military, an army of Europe. And I really believe that time has come. The armed forces of Europe must be created.
Well, let's cross to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who is following developments in Munich for us. Good to have you with us, Lise. How are Mr. Zelensky's words being received where you are?
Well, you heard him there, very strongly worded speech, no diplomatic niceties, basically telling Europe to get its act together, not just to echo the call that's made by European leaders themselves. Now it has to be said that they have to take more responsibility for their own defence, increase their spending on defence matters. But President Zelensky wants them to go even further in setting up an army of Europe. And when I spoke to, just after that, to the European Union's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, she was a bit taken aback because it was happening. We were speaking just as President Zelensky was finishing his speech. And of course, on her mind, as well as on the minds of everyone here pretty well, is just what kind of relationship is there going to be between the United States and its European partners in this, what's called the transatlantic partnership, especially when it comes to what they all say is their goal to end this war in Ukraine. So I first asked Kaja Kallas, did she believe, given what she'd heard the first day from the U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance and others, that the United States would continue the kind of security partnership with Europe that has worked for Europe in the past?
We have had good meetings with the Americans. Inside the rooms, they are saying that they continue with NATO. We are good allies. And these are the messages that we also want to hear, that we are in this together. Of course, publicly, they are also acting, and addressing their domestic public, which is sometimes a bit different.
The message from America is that Europe has to do much more. You have to increase your defense spending. You even have to look at your own societies. Is Europe going to step up?
We have heard this before when President Trump was in the office last time. And since then, a lot has changed because Europeans have heard the message loud and clear. We have stepped up our defense spending. We are doing more. But of course, in the situation where Russia is investing more than 9% of its GDP on military, we need to do more ourselves as well. So we need to do this, but we also need to do it together with the Americans.
The main message from President Zelensky, one of the main messages, is that he needs security guarantees. The message we're getting from the United States now is any kind of security force in the event of a peace deal will be European-owned, European-led and paid for. Can Europe do it alone?
The strongest security guarantee there is, and actually the cheapest security guarantee there is a NATO membership, because we know that those countries covered by the NATO's umbrella do not have war. And of course, if we discuss the security guarantees, then we really need to answer the questions, what are these security guarantees? And of course, we need to do them together with the Americans. Europe is doing a lot. If you think about the helping Ukraine, we have helped them with 134 billion euros, whereas Americans have also done their share, and we need to do this together.
The United States is making it clear, NATO membership is not in the cards. It's also making clear this is Europe's war. If they continue to say that, you must be a very worried European Union foreign policy chief.
We have discussed this, and we will have a meeting also with the foreign ministers of the European Union tomorrow morning to discuss. And so far, we have been united, and it's clear that we need to do more for our defense. But we also need to convince the Americans why the Ukrainian sovereignty is not the only question about them. It's also a question about European sovereignty, but much broadly, the security of transatlantic relationship, but also the security of the whole world.
You believe in your powers of persuasion with President Trump's team?
We have to do a lot of, convincing. That is very clear. But in terms of numbers, the numbers are there. Americans and Europeans, we are very intertwined when it comes to economy, for example. So whatever happens here also has an effect on America.
Putting a brave face on the real doubts here among the Europeans about exactly how this relationship will unfold in President Trump's second term in office. And I should conclude by saying that when I asked her specifically about President Zelensky's call for a European army, she said, well, I don't think it's a good idea. We already have NATO. We have to work on that. With the Americans, of course, too. And Europe has its own armies as well. So she didn't feel there had to be a new army set up.
Lise, whilst that interview was playing, we had this from the Reuters news agency saying that G7 foreign ministers have said that any future sanctions on Russia should be linked to whether Russia enters real good faith efforts to bring long-lasting end to the war in Ukraine. I wonder, in your opinion, how Russia might be looking at these potential cracks in the NATO alliance.
Well, obviously, that would play into Russia's hand. And I should say, President Putin got another gift from President Trump when President Trump, in one of his musings about the situation in the world, said that he thought that Russia should rejoin the G7, not that they should actually be taking action against Russia. But I should underline that there is concern here, a little bit of confusion, because they get conflicting messages from different members of President Trump's administration. And even though President Trump, after his phone call with President Putin, didn't say that he'd indicated there could be any sanctions or pressure on Russia if it didn't go along with the peace deal, the J.D. Vance, the vice president who's here, said in an interview before the Munich Security Conference that there would be possible sanctions and maximum pressure on Russia if they didn't go along with the kind of peace deal that could bring a peace to Ukraine that would be lasting and wouldn't end up in erupting in another war again.
Lise, it's clear from that interview that Europe is putting on a united front where it can. But from your conversations on the sidelines there at that conference, and those sideline conversations are so important to our coverage, how worried are people that the US is stepping back from its defence commitments for Ukraine?
Very worried. Before the Munich Security Conference even began, I spoke to the former chairman of this conference, who's got decades of experience, and Wolfgang Ischiger, and he even said that what they call the rules-based international order is more or less shattered now when you have a U.S. president who seems to be, in Europe's view, rewarding President Putin after his illegal invasion of a neighboring country. And what you hear, Krupa, is that they all accept that Europe has to do more. Mark Rutte, who's the NATO Secretary General, said to me, it's up to Europe now. He said, even though the US is calling for 5%, that's way too much, but he said European governments have to spend more than 3%. There is a sense of taking on responsibility, but there's also a real nervousness because they know that if there is to be an effective security guarantee for NATO, for Ukraine going forward, it has to include the United States.
Yes, and of course that message again in that interview that NATO membership is the only way to secure a guarantee for Ukraine, but something that the US insists is off the table right now.
That stunned everyone that the US Defense Secretary Peter Hegseth would say that even before real talks have started. And of course, for Ukraine, this it has made it clear from the very beginning that joining NATO is one of its most important goals and sees it as the most effective deterrent against any further Russian incursions into its territory. And for the Americans to, what Peter Hegseth said was, you have to be realistic. And it is true that there are many members of NATO who say it is unrealistic to expect that Ukraine will join anytime soon. But to say that before negotiations means you've effectively taken one of the main bargaining chips off the table. There are others, though. The British Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, said that the path to NATO for Ukraine was irreversible.
Thanks very much, Lise Doucette, for us there in Munich. And there is plenty more on what is happening there. And of course, that speech from Volodymyr Zelensky over on our news page online. Coming up, we celebrate the double bass with a musician who has played it for more than 70 years.
I would say any connection you can have with any instrument, you will love classical music even more when you know something about playing any instrument you play. But bass is very rewarding because of the depth of the feeling that it causes in you.
And the headlines from our newsroom. Ukraine's President Zelensky has called on Europe to create its own army in the face of the threat from Russia and not depend on the United States for military support, as we were hearing there from Lise. And Hamas has released another 3 Israeli hostages from captivity in Gaza in return for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners being held in Israeli jails. This is Krupa Party with NewsHour coming to you live from London's new broadcasting house. Now, a short time ago, Hamas released 3 more Israeli hostages as part of the first stage of that Gaza ceasefire plan. Friends and relatives cheered as they watched it happen. Those released are the dual nationals Alexander Truvanov, Yair Horn and Segi Dekelchen. This, of course, comes after Hamas said on Monday it would not release any hostages this weekend, blaming Israel for alleged violations of the ceasefire. Meanwhile, the release of 369 Palestinian prisoners is also underway. There is understandably great relief on both sides of that dividing line. Let's get more on the day's events so far with Mark Lowen. Mark, first of all, tell us more about those released today and, of course, their condition.
Hi, Grupa. Yes, these are three men who were all taken from the same kibbutz on the 7th of October 2023 during those Hamas attacks. They were taken from kibbutz near Oz, which saw a quarter of its population either killed or kidnapped. And as you say, all three are dual nationals, Israeli-American, Israeli-Russian, and Israeli-Argentinian. Sagi Dekelchen, who is one of the three that's been released, has been reunited with his wife, who gave birth to their third daughter 2 months after he was seized by Hamas. And so he has just met, he will be meeting his newest daughter, who was born while he was in captivity. Sasha Trufanov, his father, was killed on the 7th of October in the attacks. And Yair Horn, the third released hostage, his brother is still in captivity in Gaza. So a mixture of obviously huge joy for them being reunited with their family, but also the pain that they're coming back to and that they are now having to deal with. They are in hospital being reunited with their families and undergoing thorough medical examinations. And here in Hostages Square in Tel Aviv, we watched as images of their release were beamed live from Gaza here. And as you heard, there was the relief and the delight. And then we watched one of the helicopters coming over from Gaza and transporting them to the hospital here in Tel Aviv, where they will remain for a few days.
So a positive sign for that first phase of the ceasefire agreement. But of course, all eyes turn to the uncertainty surrounding that crucial second phase.
Yes, and given what has happened over the last few days, there are ever greater doubts over whether we will even get to the second phase of the three-phased ceasefire deal. Because last week, of course, Hamas said that it would suspend today's hostage release, blaming Israel for violating the terms of the ceasefire, something that Israel denies. And added to that, you've got Donald Trump wading into the debate, suggesting that the United States should take over Gaza and expel the Palestinians from the Gaza Strip, which has made Hamas, I think, or certainly feel that there is no prospect of a longer term ceasefire deal to stick to. And on top of that, a third dimension is the political pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu from within his cabinet, from the right wing of his cabinet, who want him to resume the war when the hostages are released. And of course, the second phase of the ceasefire deal, which is due to come into place in early March, would foresee an Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. So, you know, the negotiations on that second phase were meant to begin last week. They have not begun in earnest. There is a chasm of mistrust between these two sides that has only deepened in recent days, and there are real doubts over the viability and longer-term survival of this ceasefire deal.
Mark Lowen for us there in Tel Aviv. Thank you for joining us. As part of his plan to cut alleged federal government waste, President Donald Trump is literally pinching pennies. He has ordered his Treasury Secretary to stop the US Mint from producing new 1-cent coins. Mr. Trump said the cost of minting the coin featuring the profile of the country's 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, is more than twice the currency's face value. Let's talk more about this with Robert Waples, professor of economics at Wake Forest University and a research fellow with the Independent Institute in North Carolina. Thanks for being with us, Robert. An end to minting the penny. Is this long overdue in your opinion?
Yeah, very long overdue. The essential problem isn't just that it costs actually more than 3 cents to mint a penny, but that the value of the penny has fallen so little in comparison to the value of our time due to inflation that people don't even stoop over to pick a penny up, and they don't bring their pennies back to the store. And so the store then has to ask eventually the mint to make more of them, setting this vicious cycle in motion.
But put simply, Robert, it's still money. And I think about all those charities who collect millions from all that spare change that people donate at checkouts. Who loses out by not having a penny, in your opinion?
I think what can happen with the charities is they say, hey, we're, you know, cleaning out the pennies, bring in all your empty jars because nobody's going to be using them anymore. And then they can change their penny charity into a nickel charity, nickels of 5 cent piece here in the U.S. But I think there's really only two groups that lose out in this process. And that is the people who work at the U.S. Mint, because about half of the coins they make are pennies. And then the people in the zinc industry, they have been lobbying a long time, a group called Americans for Common Sense, Our penny is 97.5% zinc, so they're going to lose out a little bit. But here's where my research comes in. What I found was in looking at the cash register total at the last digit, so all these prices end with 9, like $1.99. So if you were to round that up to $2, people are afraid that you're going to get ripped off. But because people purchase multiple items and we then put taxes on at the end of this, I found that the last digit is completely random in your cash register total. So it's as likely that $1.99 gets rounded to $2 as $2.01 gets rounded down to $2. So the customer is not going to get rooked in the process, according to my research.
Should we spare a thought for those who have a sense of cultural nostalgia around the pennies, collecting them in their piggy banks as kids?
Well, we certainly do, because when I was a kid, a penny was valuable. You could go down to the gumball machine at the grocery store and get a piece of gum. It was great. And pennies stand out. I mean, all the other coins are kind of silvery looking, and it's so beautiful and shiny and copper looking, the penny. So we all have a very fond memory of these. But I would say that it's kind of disrespectful to Abraham Lincoln and to the penny itself, the way we treat it. We just leave it on the sidewalk. We just leave it in our jar and we never bring it back. So probably time to get rid of the dear old penny.
But briefly, Robert, practically speaking, how does this happen? Because is it entirely in Trump's hand to push this through? There must be a process.
Yeah, so the U.S. Constitution gives Congress the power to, you know, decide about the minting of coins. But this is also delegated to the executive branch, and they can decide if we're going to make more or fewer. It's not clear that they can go all the way down to zero, so maybe that'll be tested, but I doubt anybody's going to sue over this thing. If another president in 4 years wants to undo it, that person could, and I really doubt that they will. So I think what's going to happen in the long run is that stores will run out of pennies. They'll ask people to bring some in like they did during COVID when they were running out of change. And maybe people will, but maybe they won't have enough. And so eventually they'll just start saying, we're going to round our cash price to the nearest 5 cents. So this will take place over years, maybe even more than a decade before, you know, we finally see the penny disappear from American commerce.
Interesting. Very good to get your insights. An interesting subject there. Robert Waples, Professor of Economics at Wake Forest University, giving us his take on that call from President Donald Trump, one of many calls that we've heard in recent weeks, this time to phase out the 1 cent coin in the United States. Stay with us here on NewsHour. There is plenty more coming up after a short BBC World Service bulletin. You're listening to NewsHour. Hollywood has long been known as Tinseltown, a dream factory at the heart of the global entertainment industry. But nowadays, it's much cheaper and much more popular to film in London, Toronto, or even Sydney. But now that many filmmakers and movie stars have lost their homes, there are calls for a boost in local TV and film production to be part of the fire recovery effort. The BBC's Regan Morris reports from Los Angeles.
Quiet on set has taken on a whole new meaning as
industry jobs are leaving California.
But for many in the industry, business still has not bounced back.
LA's film crews say it is far too quiet on the set, as productions move to other countries in search of cheaper labor and better tax breaks. The wildfires, which killed at least 29 people and destroyed thousands of homes, have only added to Hollywood's existential crisis.
So many people in LA have been out of work.
Director Sarah Adina Smith co-founded Stay in LA in response to the wildfires.
We are asking for emergency relief to include uncapping the tax incentive for any production that shoots in LA County for the next 3 years. And then the second really crucial piece of that is calling upon studios and streamers to increase the amount of production they're doing in LA County for 3 years by 10%. And the grander point of all of this, if we let Hollywood die, it could be for good.
Nearly 20,000 people, including actors Keanu Reeves, Zooey Deschanel, and Kevin Bacon, have signed the Stay in LA petition.
Governor Newsom proposing a big boost to Hollywood, raising tax credits for film and TV by more than $400 million every year.
Before the fires, Governor Newsom proposed more than doubling the state's film and TV incentives to $750 million. but that wouldn't come into effect until at least the summer, if it's approved by the legislature. Critics say the tax breaks amount to corporate welfare, but that they're a necessary evil if LA wants to compete. Australia, Canada, and the UK now all have more lucrative tax deals for filmmakers than California.
Oh, oranges.
Yeah, that was an orange tree.
Yes. Production designer Mark Worthington lost his home in the Eaton Fire. He says many fire victims won't be able to stay and rebuild if there's no work.
Well, I haven't worked in 2 years, and it seems very clear there are two things happening. One is the general reduction in production, which we've seen, and that's worldwide. And then there is also seemingly the very conscious offshoring of production to avoid, seems to me, avoid union work, union rates and union benefits.
And what would you like to see done? Like, clearly you're more expensive than
We're
the rest of the people around the globe,
no,
but what do you think should happen?
The thing the studios could do to help us out, give us jobs, bring film back, bring television back. That'd be great. And I know they're giving millions to immediate relief, food and shelter and all the rest of it, and that's wonderful, and I applaud them for it. If they really want to help us, employ us.
It's not clear if studios or the state will heed their calls. They've not responded to requests for comment.
Regan Morris for us there in LA. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. This is NewsHour live from London. Thank you for being with us. I'm Krupa Bhatti. To the conflict in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where M23 rebels have entered Bukavu, the eastern region's second largest city. Reports say there was little resistance from the Congolese army and the militia allied with it. Corneille Nangaa, leader of the Congo River Alliance, which includes M23 rebels, told Reuters that the rebels had entered the South Kivu provincial capital on Friday evening and would continue their advance throughout Saturday. And this comes as the heads of states from various countries across Africa meet at an African Union summit in Ethiopia. And at that summit, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged dialogue.
In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the Congolese people have been suffering yet again from a brutal cycle of violence. And the fighting that is raging in South Kivu as a result of the continuation of the M23 offensive threatens to push the entire region over the precipice. There is no military solution. The deadlock must end, the dialogue must begin, and the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the DRC must be respected.
Concern there from the UN's Antonio Guterres. Now, context is ever important. This conflict is taking place in the mineral-rich east of the country, one which has been dogged by conflict since the 1994 Rwandan genocide, when about 800,000 people, the vast majority of them from the Tutsi community, were slaughtered by ethnic Hutu extremists. The M23 is backed by Rwanda and led by ethnic Tutsis, who say they needed to take up arms to protect the rights of the minority group. Well, there's panic and there's concern in Bukavu. One resident who asked us not to share her name told us about what is happening where she is.
The things are not easy. People are afraid. We feel that we are abandoned by the authorities, either the military, the political, all the authorities, if they are no longer there. We are afraid because of the crackling of the bullets. Many people are going to loot, especially the youth. They are in the streets, destroying the shops, even some storage places for the World Food Program is destroyed. But those who have the means, they stay home. Yeah, like me, and the streets are empty, except those who go in the street for looting. This is the situation now.
And you've shared some videos of people looting with us. It looks like it's a very chaotic scene. These young people, you said, they are looting stores and other warehouses.
The fact of looting is not a good behavior. Many people are extremely poor. For them, it's hard to even have 1 kilogram of salt. I'm not justifying the fact that they are looting because I discourage it, but I think also in the opposition, it's because, maybe because we are abandoned by the local authorities. No one is ruling, no one is deciding. That's why they are looting. Don't know who is shooting and why, but the people who are in the streets, they continue to destroy the shops. They loot the different shops and offices because no one is ruling.
You must be hugely worried, you and your family. What are you doing to keep safe? How are you trying to keep safe?
To keep safe, we choose some places where we are far from the windows to avoid going outside. Otherwise, we can be taken by any bullet. Yeah. We would wish to leave Bukavu and to go far from the places where we are, but we don't know where to go. We are limited financially because even if we go there, we need to carry some food, to have some money with us. And with this, as we are limited, we decided to stay with my family and my husband.
You're staying in your house to keep safe, away from the windows, as you just described. Do you have enough food, water?
I only have something that can be sufficient for 3 days. In case we don't have possibility to get food, we can make some porridge to help us survive.
What are you most afraid about?
You know, in Bukavu, some people are into the army groups, the different army groups. Like now, we heard that some DRC soldiers left, but the fighting, we don't know who is leading it. Now we can hear the shooting outside. Who is fighting, we don't know. So I'm afraid of those people who may continue to loot, who can enter into these different houses, and maybe who can decide to bomb some of the cities. It is difficult for me as a woman to go outside, because if I go outside, either I can be raped by someone who is in this position of looting or who maybe belong to any army group. But also, I am afraid of any bullets that can take me.
A resident of Bukavu there, speaking to us a few hours ago. She asked us not to share her name because she is so worried about her security. So we do appreciate her taking the time to talk to us. She also shared those videos of the looters that she received, giving us a sense of what is happening there on the streets of Bukavu. Now it is time for a musical treat. That is the double bass player Orin O'Brien playing with a colleague. In 1996, O'Brien became the first female permanent member of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, where she stayed for an eye-watering 55 years. She is now 89 and has only just retired. She was recruited by the legendary composer and conductor Leonard Bernstein, and her story has been made into a documentary by her niece Molly O'Brien and is up for an Oscar. My colleague Rebecca Kesby had the pleasure of speaking to Orin and began by asking her, why the double bass?
Well, the bass actually chose me. First of all, I was 5'9" at age 12. I was very nearsighted. I wore thick glasses. Those were the days before contact lenses. You know, braids and glasses, and too tall for a girl at that time. I was going to high school. I heard the first assembly I heard as a freshman, the school orchestra played, and the concertmaster played the Saint-Saëns Rondo Capriccioso, and I thought, oh my gosh, they sound professional. I want to be part of that. So I ran up to the conductor afterwards and said, can I please join the orchestra? He said, what do you play? I play piano. Oh, we've got plenty of pianos. Oh, you're tall. We need a bass player. If you go in that closet and take out a bass, I'll give you the name of a teacher. If you study for 6 months, I'll let you in the orchestra. That was it.
And that was the beginning of
was
the
hooked.
Love affair.
And going into the orchestra, I had the fun of playing with other musicians,
well,
which was completely thrilling to me.
So this is something that comes out in the film.
Yeah.
The fact that you kind of see orchestral music as a team event, and you describe in the film the bass section as being the floor that supports everything else.
Totally. Oh, totally. It's very important and it's very thrilling.
Let me take you back to the 60s, because this is when you joined the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, one of the most famous orchestras in the world. And at the time, you were the only woman. And looking back at some of the archive of that time and how you were written about, I mean, I laughed when I heard what the newspapers wrote about you.
Really.
But I mean, it really was quite a sexist environment, not necessarily in the orchestra, but in the wider media. How were you described?
The article in Time magazine was, I think, one of the most offensive, because it said that I dressed in a washroom because there was no women's dressing room. At that time, there was no need for one. So I dressed in the bathroom. Of course, that was only the only place to dress. I played in many different organizations before I joined the Philharmonic. I worked for 5 years at the Metropolitan Opera down in the old house, which was built in the 1880s on 40th Street and Broadway. And I played in New York City Ballet for 10 years. So I was well acquainted with a lot of different professional environments and no place to dress. And you found whatever bathroom you could.
Oren, your story is brilliantly told in this new film, which has been put together by your niece. And I understand that you were totally reluctant to be part of this project. How did she persuade you, and why were you so reluctant?
Well, first of all, I don't like doing PR because to me, it's peripheral and it's nothing to do with the actual playing of music. I found it uncomfortable to talk about myself because I looked upon myself as a cog in the machine. I was part of the group and I didn't want to stick out from the group, also because that I thought it may cause resentment and envy. It's a strange feeling of being separated by all this publicity from your colleagues.
But this film has now been nominated for an Oscar, and it's an important story to tell of those years of being a woman in that environment and achieving, you know, what you have managed to. How did your niece persuade you that you should do this film? And did you, in the end, feel a sense of obligation, of responsibility to tell new audiences and younger people what it's been like?
When she told me, look, if you make this and if it's a successful film, perhaps more people will be interested in classical music. And that is part of what moved me to agree. And the second thing was she agreed to feature teaching and my students. And I love my students.
So if there were any young people listening, most people, I guess, are kind of thinking, oh, maybe I should play the violin or the piano or the flute, what would you say to a young person who is musical to persuade them that the double bass is the way to go?
Well, I don't want to push the double bass on someone who's not attracted to it, but I have to tell you, any instrument that you can get together with one or two other people and make music, you feel the vibrations of the instrument in your body. I would say any connection you can have with any instrument, you will love classical music even more when you know something about playing any instrument you play. But bass is very rewarding because of the depth of the feeling that it causes in you.
A lovely end to Oren O'Brien's work there. She was in conversation with Rebecca Kesby. She says she doesn't like the attention of the media and the PR, so we are even more grateful that she took the time to talk to us. And how is that for a record? Several decades playing an instrument. How do you fare? 89 she is. Sounds incredible still. This is NewsHour. There is more coming up. Stay with us.
This is Krupa Party with NewsHour live on the BBC World Service. In Paris this week, the biggest names in the world of artificial intelligence, together with politicians and other business leaders, gathered for an AI Action Summit. This is a follow-up to the AI Safety Summit in Bletchley Park in England back in 2023. And one of the key talking points at this summit has been the way in which AI could radically alter the world of work, its threats, and indeed its possible promises too. And that is something I've been talking about with the illustrator Holly Exley and Carsten Jung, a former economist at the Bank of England, who is now at the Institute for Public Policy Research, a think tank in London. I began by asking Carsten what his key takeaways are from the AI summit in Paris this week, which he attended.
My key takeaways would be that people are taking AI seriously. You know, it was a very busy summit with lots of side events, people from all over the world. People have clearly woken up to the potential of this technology. I would say, you know, there was lots happening, but the most energy was in accelerating AI deployment. And, you know, in different ways, the Americans are all guns blazing on big tech, whereas sort of the French organizers said, we need our own European AI. But it was all about how can we do AI faster and sort of slightly in our own way. But there was very little discussion around how do we actually manage this transition if we get all this AI, if it does arrive in the labor market, if it does, you know, pop up in our social lives. Already in the UK, 1 million people use AI as a companion. And we're not currently having the discussion if we actually want that kind of AI. And of course, in the labor market, it will turn up as well very soon, or has already. And not so much discussion on what to do about it.
Yeah, interesting that focus has been on doing AI faster. With that in mind, what jobs, what roles do you think are most at risk and why?
I think the jobs that will first feel this are sort of back office jobs that can be summarized as that, or white collar jobs. And in particular, it's jobs such as personal assistants, secretaries, marketing associates, customer service professionals, people that work with data entry or data processing. Those are all sort of traditional so-called back office jobs. And actually in the UK, a lot of people are in these jobs. If you just add together the ones I mentioned, you almost get to 1 million people in the UK. And those are jobs you could do remotely, are perhaps those that are at risk first. It's also quite interesting that those type of jobs are more likely to be held by women, 40% more likely. So it's kind of the opposite of the last technological wave that we saw in manufacturing and automation there, that was disproportionately affecting men. Now, disproportionately, it could be affecting women. I think policy and politicians should be on the front foot about this, unlike last time where we didn't do enough to manage the impacts of this.
Well, this is a good point to bring Holly into our conversation. Holly, tell us about your skill set and how you believe AI is impacting your work.
My work is in freelance illustration here in the UK, and I've been doing this full time for about 12 years now. So I mostly work in the publishing industry. I make images for books and board games, and I work with magazines and marketing projects and with independent businesses as well. So my main concern when it comes to AI is definitely job loss and my career becoming obsolete in time. And my particular concern is with AI generative art. These are programs where a user can input a few prompts describing the kinds of images they want for a particular project or something, and then artificial intelligence, after using a lot of human art that exists on the internet, for example, to train on, they can then create an output which would be a piece of art for the user. As you can see, this could completely omit the need for a human artist or illustrator.
Here's a question though. Do you believe AI art is as good as human art? What does it do better? What does it do worse?
I think this is something that could change quite rapidly, but at the moment, the AI art that I've seen, I don't think compares with human-made art. I definitely think it's something that's hard to put into words. It's more like an instinctual thing. I find the images kind of cheesy, and there's also this real lack of attention to detail at the moment when it comes to things like anatomy or details in backgrounds, like light and texture, and even issues with things like gravity. Just think the small details within an image that don't really make sense because they haven't been made by a human.
Carsten, there's lots of talk about the potential of AI, but what can be done to protect certain industries?
I think maybe the conversation shouldn't be, should we protect entire industries and not allow AI there? But I think a way to think about this is that almost no job is fully automatable or fully, you know, every single task can be done by AI. I don't know, if you take teachers, in theory, I guess you can think about how an entire teacher could be automated by AI, but a lot of the face-to-face work can't be done. And there is a question of like, how can we, and this by we, I mean people holding jobs, unions, employers, and government, how can we proactively think about what tasks could be affected and how can we help people transition to do more of the things that are the face-to-face tasks? How can people do more of the things that we don't want AI to do? And I think in jobs like illustration, one thing that humans might be very good at is sitting down with the clients, really understanding what the needs are and having the sort of last mile service that involves really deeply understanding what customers want. That will be quite difficult to automate, and sort of slightly helping people pivot towards doing more of that and perhaps using AI in early drafts or in early development of certain products. I think that that's where the initial action will be, is really helping people double down on the things where AI isn't good and protecting those areas perhaps. And again, it's like unions, policymakers and job holders.
Well, Holly, what are you doing specifically to either cope or combat the change from AI?
I think the way that I will be pivoting in the future, if it does become normal for AI to be used in my particular field, which would be publishing, I plan to contextualise my art a lot more and have a focus on the process, the human being behind the artwork, focus on my work, which is in watercolour. So it's quite a tactile medium. It makes you think of human hands creating brush strokes. So I'll be focusing more on storytelling and perhaps like a more bespoke experience. Perhaps I might move more into selling original artwork and working more with individuals on commissions and that kind of thing.
And that was the illustrator Holly Exley, and you also heard from Carsten Jung, who is an economist with the Institute for Public Policy Research. And that is it from this edition of NewsHour. Thank you for your company, and do stay with the BBC World Service.